Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to New Books in American Studies. I'm the co-host of the channel, Lillian Barger. Today, my conversation with James Alexander Dunn, Assistant Professor of History at Princeton University. His book, Dangerous Neighbors, Making the Haitian Revolution in Early America, published by the University of Pennsylvania Press, is a topic of this show. Dunn provides a detailed examination of how the Haitian Revolution shaped Americans' view of their own revolution, their relations with both England and France, and left an imprint on the domestic ideological battles between Federalists and Republicans. Philadelphia, a center for anti-slavery activity and a stage for revolutionary ideas, was actively engaged in trade with the French colony of Saint Domingue. Newspapers, letters, and eyewitness accounts from merchant ships provide Dunn with a window into how the Haitian Revolution influenced domestic politics. Attempting to understand the meaning of the French Revolution, people and ideas from Saint-Domingue flooded the city, dividing citizens over the meaning of rebellion, revolution, freedom, and slavery. Dunn has deciphered complex events and shown how Haiti became a symbol of all that was right and wrong in the revolutionary Atlantic. Here is my conversation with James Alexander Dunn. Now, let me introduce you to the author, James Alexander Dunn. Alec, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thank you for sharing your thoughts with our audience. Before we get into the book, tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and how you came to write Dangerous Neighbors.
Well, I'm a historian. I teach at Princeton University. I'm a historian of early America, which, as your listeners probably know, these days tends to mean that you don't just study a single place, but you think about a wider space, typically spreading out across waters and lands. I tend to spread out from west to east, thinking about the Caribbean and the Atlantic littoral as a space. Even though I do study temporally the 18th century mostly, and therefore I do think about nation states and specifically the United States, but I tend to think about it in terms of a wider Atlantic context. And that's certainly related to how I came to the topic of this book. I found it quite difficult to think about the American Revolution without immediately beginning to think about the Haitian Revolution.
Now, your book is extremely complicated, I would say. Not because your arguments are particularly complicated, but the events in that you deal with between 1790 roughly and 1884, there's a lot of events that are happening. It's not just the Haitian Revolution. We think of it as a moment in time, one thing that happened, but lots of things happen leading up to it. And so there's a lot of players. So a lot of people. There's the French. There's the Americans. There's the Haitians. There's the slaves, the free, the colored, the white colonials. There's a lot of people. There's the merchant ships and the news editors. And so talk to us a little bit for the audience. The key events that you're dealing with in this sort of roughly 14, 15 years.
Right. And well, I'd start off by saying that your observation is exactly the point. This thing that we as moderns, modern audiences tend to think of in one fell swoop, the Haitian Revolution, was a series of very complex current events, of course, over this nearly 15-year period of time. And you know, my starting point of my analysis is really that Americans, and among many other audiences, were watching those events, and they were watching them in real time, and they were interested in them. That was a sort of, you know, sine qua non of what I was trying to do in the book. If they hadn't been interested in them, there wouldn't have been any point of charting these events. So you asked what the principal moments were?
Yeah, and I think I would start probably with the French Revolution, that first,
right,
and how it affected both Americans in Philadelphia, because you do a focus on what was going on in Philadelphia, and we'll talk about why Philadelphia.
Sure.
But how was the French Revolution received in Philadelphia or in the Americas, and what happened to what we now call Haiti, that mm-hmm. area of the West Indies,
yeah,
how the French Revolution affected that island?
Well, Americans were, of all sort of walks of life, really fascinated in the developments in Paris that we now understand. And people at the time, too, I will hasten to add, understood as a French Revolution. That was sort of something they accepted as a revolutionary set of events right away. There's a lot of reasons for that interest. The alliance with France, which had, you know, been an important part of American independence, but also the fact that the French revolutionaries themselves, but also Americans looking there, saw lots of connections between what had happened and what was still unfolding in the American polity and this new and momentous set of events that was taking place in Paris, especially after 1792, when the French declare themselves to be a republic. Americans can look there and say, this is, you know, some sort of sister republic. And indeed, the French revolutionary ideology for a time there is really rooted in this expansionist notion that republics everywhere are engaged in a battle against monarchy everywhere. And it's a global struggle. And there's quite real political ramifications for that belief on the part of the French. And there's a good degree of acceptance of that idea among certain Americans who say, yes, we should be engaged in battling the British, who are still kind of, snipping at our heels a bit in North America, or the Spanish as well. So all that's kind of the environment in which these events in Saint-Domingue begin to unfold. That's the French colonial name for the place that eventually becomes called Haiti. And Americans quite reasonably look at these events and see them as what they call the French Revolution in Saint Domingo. It's always Saint Domingo, not Saint-Domingue, in American mouths, as far as I can make out. Initially, what they're seeing, is, say, circa late 1789 into 1790, is a variety of different sorts of fights over the French Revolution among various groups in Saint-Domingue. This is principally a struggle between white factions, folks who are looking at the events in Paris and saying, maybe this is something that we can use or will signal a shift in our relationship as a colony to that metropolitan center. Indeed, they look quite consciously to their neighbors to the north, to the United States, and say, maybe this is the beginning of an American revolution, quote unquote, amongst their interests. They hope that maybe there'll be a new regime of freer trade in the new French polity, where they can do more business with American merchants, quite honestly. Maybe means independence, some of them. As the French Revolution takes various turns, there is a group of them who emerge as kind of royalists who don't want to follow the French path anymore. But at the same time, there are French metropolitan officials in the island, army officers, governors, intendants, these sorts of things, who don't want their authority to be jeopardized. So we have factional sort of squabbling going on in this early stage. Crucially, there's a significant body of people known as the gens de couleur, the people of color, free people who are often significant small property owners, oftentimes slave owners, but of mixed race, who hope that same struggle, especially when it gets attached to ideas like liberty, equality, and fraternity, and the rights of man, will mean a reversal of the increasing discrimination they're facing in Dominican society. So that's going on. Did you want to jump in?
Well, yeah. I wanted to ask you a question about how much of the population on Saint Domingo are slaves at this point?
The vast majority, something like 500,000.
But is it like 90% of the population?
It's probably close to 95%, I would say. There's something like 25 or so thousand white colonists, around 30,000 free people of color. And then there's, you know, this massive majority of African and Afro-Creole people who are these enslaved population.
Okay, so what is the relationship at this point? Now, we talked about a little bit about Americans, their response to the French Revolution. Now, when the Reign of Terror comes, of course, people are backing away and going, maybe this French Revolution really isn't like our revolution, and maybe we don't really like it that much. So Americans are not unified in what they think about the French Revolution, especially
Absolutely.
When it starts to turn violent and there's a lot of the king is executed and all this.
That is a signal moment right there.
Right.
Absolutely.
Now,
Go ahead. Well, I would say that part of that reaction to the violence of the French Revolution, to the the political radicalism that's involved in some of those shifts that you just mentioned in France itself, is filtered through this news from the most important French colony, which is Saint-Domingue. This is a place that is absolutely central to the French economy. It is the most successful plantation colony the world has ever seen. Its exports, for example, are something like triple that of all the British West Indian Islands combined. It is an absolute economic powerhouse. So as those factional struggles are taking place, and then the famous insurrections, these series of insurrections that begin in August 1791 across the northern part of the colony, then also begin thereafter in the western part of the colony in a different way in the southern part of the colony. Americans have a lot of stimuli by which to judge this French place and what some of them could see as the mal effects of French revolutionary, directions or ideas. That becomes an even more a possible reaction when there are some really interesting French revolutionary moments that take place in this Caribbean context. At one point, metropolitan officials trying to do anything they can to try to preserve or reestablish some sort of order, give rights, a limited degree of rights to people of color, sort of admitting them to be citizens, a right that is then sanctioned in Paris. That's one sort of move that Americans look at and are interested in. But even more astounding, and this is something I think even French revolutionary historians are still coming to and thinking about more and more. Again, scrabbling to maintain their control and in the face of these factional fights and this slave violence, revolutionary French officials declare any enslaved or person who's fighting as an insurgent against them, who will join the French side to be free. That takes place in June of 1793. And that move, a couple months later, February 1794, is sanctioned in Paris and expanded to the entire French Empire. So in one fell swoop, after a pretty minimal debate, as far as I can make out, there is no more slavery in the French possessions on the earth. It's not exactly true, right? Because some places resist it, but, nevertheless, thereafter, without any sort of compensation, without any provision for their removal from the polity, as many other emancipatory regimes allow, these freed people can become something like a French citizen. They certainly can become fighters in French armies, which is what the French armies really need in the West Indies so far away. So that's a pretty big moment. And Americans look at that in the same context they do with the terror and say, whoa, this is interesting. Sometimes most are against it, some are for it, but they're all interested in it.
Okay, before the revolutionary government in France or Paris declares slaves free if they join the revolutionary cause, there were a bunch of mini rebellions, insurrections, and who's fighting who here? This is where it got really muddled. You've got the colonials. White colonials, you've got colored people, you've got slaves. Are slaves involved also in that before they're declared emancipated? And who are they fighting with? Are they fighting with the...
This is a great question. It's really important. Yeah. I mean, this is where, scholars among myself, others among me, study, what insurrectionary slaves are fighting for and how they're related to other non-enslaved population struggles in lots of different ways. And I think the best answer is that different slaves rebelled for different specific reasons. Some would have been rebelling, thinking that, say, the Spanish monarch was a safer route to some sort of alleviation or removal of slavery for them. Others were armed by the whites or the free coloreds, the gens de couleur, in their own squabbles. But then even those may have taken those arms and done things differently than their putative sort of allies might have wanted. I think the safest thing to say is that, you know, whenever a group of people who are enslaved are able to mobilize themselves in significant numbers and to fight against that slavery violently, they are acting to reverse some particular aspect of their enslavement and maybe some general aspect of their enslavement. And are risking their all to at that effort, right? Whether any of them or are trying to overturn slavery everywhere or even all over an entire colony, I think that's a different kind of question. At some level, yes, there are some people saying we want slavery to no longer exist in this colony. There are examples that suggest that some of the enslaved insurgent leaders, rather, decide they've gotten enough. They've secured control of different portions of the colony and say, so want to treat with various officials and maybe say, yeah, I'll be free and my lieutenants will be free and my army will have a free day a week, but we'll go back to the plantations. In many cases, those leaders are not followed. And in fact, the insurgents, the wider body of insurgents say, no, that's not significant enough a change. So too, even the French decree of emancipation doesn't bring all slaves to the French side or all at once. Some slaves who are in arms or maybe who have simply escaped slavery around them are able to say, I've already got a degree of freedom already. I don't need a French sort of letter to explain to me that I'm now free.
And this is interesting because it's the Americans in Philadelphia are watching this and they're trying to decide whether these slaves are rebelling. What is the meaning of the rebellion? Are they just protesting against their immediate particular circumstances? You know, maybe they're not getting enough food, or they're being mistreated, or are they really actually fighting for liberty, which is a much bigger thing, which is what you're talking about.
Exactly. And so as such, that question filters right into ongoing questions and questions that are really bubbling up quite aggressively at this particular moment, beginning in the American Revolutionary context, but on and through the 1780s and into this period in the 1790s, among people in general who are questioning, slavery at a certain level itself, but also the meaning of slave violence. In other words, some folks will look at slave violence and say, well, this is proof that slavery is necessary in a certain way because it takes these naturally ferocious people and controls the threat that they bring, in addition to providing the labor that makes, you know, wealth and such. But others, drawing on, Christian ideas, evangelical Christian ideas as well, but also the sort of revolutionary era ideas about republicanism and other ideological components, say, no, these are men. And men, when they experience, or they are humans, when they experience tyranny, rebel naturally. It is a natural reaction to be violent, in other words, when you confront this tyranny. And that duality, the fact that there's different ways of understanding this violence, allows Americans observing to make it serve different ends in their own political context, to make it, say, an expression of a more sort of capital L, liberty, this happens as well, to make it more proof of the need for slavery and slavery being something that is an institution that makes sense. Or, and I think this is, one of the contributions of my book, to say, okay, slavery is a problematic institution. There's better and worse ways to do it. And the French way is obviously not working that well. Maybe the West Indian way creates this sort of problem. And rather that leading to sort of an impetus towards getting rid of slavery at home, it's a way of saying, as long as it's done in some sort of American way, with various protections.
Sure. It's like the reform of slavery.
It can be tamed in some sense.
Yes, right.
But that's not universal, and that's an idea that's in its germination, it's in its infancy, even in America. It's when I think it's going to become a real keeper among American pro-slavery ideologues. This is a safe way. It's even a humane way to deal with this problem. But there's plenty of Americans who look at this and say, look what's happening in this island, in this colony, in this place. We need to get out while the getting's still good here.
What is the relationship between San Domingo and Philadelphia? Your book is based on a lot of exchange that's happening with merchant ships, information that's coming in, trade, ideas, and then people. People are coming. They're fleeing from the island and coming to Philadelphia. Sometimes they're bringing their slaves with them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, no, the relationship, we have to remember, this is, the age of sail. This is before the telegraph. The telegraph is a really big change. It's not part of my book at all, but it's a big shift from the context I'm talking about. Because with the telegraph, you can have communication between places that are disparate and far away from each other without a human body moving between those two places. But before that, for one place that's far away from another place to know about each other, some person has to move between those two places. And to be sure, there's some travelers and tourists who do that kind of thing, and that's one way that different peoples know about other places. But the reason most people move across any sizable distance is to do business, is commerce. And Saint-Domingue is the great analogy would be. It's like the Silicon Valley of the 18th century. It is the source of immense wealth, as I hinted at already. It is a place that is, that if you're going to do business, especially as an American in the post-revolutionary context where some portions of the British West Indies have been shut out to you in a punitive way, it's a gold mine. It's a gold mine. It is the way that, among other places, but principally Saint-Domingue, is the way that Americans escape the post-American Revolution depression that they were suffering from. Because they do so much business there. I did a little bit of work to try to figure this out and quantify it. And if you look at all of the arrivals to Philadelphia, which is the biggest and busiest American port, all the arrivals there from any foreign port anywhere in the world, and you compare that to arrivals from any Dominican port, the proportion over the period I'm looking at averages about 20%. So 20% of all arrivals from anywhere in the world come from this little sliver, this eastern third of the island of Hispaniola that is Saint-Domingue. And in certain years, it's over that. In 1796, it approaches 34%. So it's a good thing to remember. So for all these reasons, because of that density of contact, thousands and thousands of voyages manned by many thousands of mariners and captains and supercargoes, these merchants, sort of junior merchants who would come to take test markets and try to make sales. There's people who are going to know all about this place because they're traveling to it. And then they're going to take that news because this place is so important commercially, because it's having all this tumult and meaningful discussion and disruptions taking place. And they're going to tell newspaper editors, a go-to thing for newspaper or procedure for newspaper editors was to inhabit the wharves of whatever port city they lived in, meeting the merchant ships as they came in to hear what mariners had seen, right? In addition to grabbing letters that mariners were bringing for publication or for transmittal and printed stuff or newspapers that came from foreign places. And these newspapers, this is, in a different era of American journalism, they wouldn't necessarily be, synthesizing and writing a report up in any sense. They'd be simply cutting and pasting or reprinting this information under the heading Saint Domingo or wherever it was from. So, one of the things I try to show in the book is how these merchant vessels are one way that information comes, and then they get into these newspaper vessels and get spread out across the Atlantic seaboard in North America. And through that, they then enter a sort of more figurative vessel of American political discourse as all these issues are being discussed and argued about and fought passionately over. Saint-Domingue is right there as part of the matter that fight is being taken through.
You also talk about in your book about the print culture of the newspaper business. I mean, it was huge in Philadelphia.
Yes.
How big was Philadelphia and how many newspapers were there? Because you do talk about it. Tell the audience about that.
It's the absolute center, in many senses, of American political and cultural life. It's the national capital. It is the commercial capital. It's the state capital and a local center. And it's also a siphoning sort of a mart for American mid-Atlantic grains, corn and wheat, to be go and to be exported out principally into the Caribbean. So it is commercially, just the way San Domingue commercially was a center, it is a center for American life. Therefore, both places, too, are cultural centers. San Domingue, before the violence and tumult of the revolutionary events, has the among the hemisphere's biggest cities, most vibrant cities, places where, European cultural things will be on exhibit for the first time, the best plays, the newest fashions, scientific observations will be made there and transmitted to Europe and to Philadelphia, where Benjamin Franklin will take them up, or the American Philosophical Society will take them up and publish them, just the same way that Philadelphia was a center in those ways, too. So there's a lot of cross-pollination of ideas and people that is only accelerated when this series of disruptions starts happening.
So ideas are coming into Philadelphia. They're being published in these as a vibrant newspaper business, print culture. But also people are coming. I thought that was interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
The colonials who are trying to escape, the white colonials who are trying to escape the violence. Mm-hmm. They fear for slave insurrection. They're fearing for the colored population. You had just mentioned before the Spanish are in there, too.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's lots of people are playing into this. So can you talk a little bit about the people who actually came into Philadelphia? And I was very interested in the ones who brought their slaves.
Yes.
And how this sort of met with free African-Americans in Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
And the anti-slavery and abolition debates that were going on in Philadelphia. And you've got people coming in, bringing their slaves with them. I mean, this is
it's an interesting set of events to come together. And because of the anti-slavery sort of ethos that you just referenced in Philadelphia, more people go elsewhere. And those who land in Philadelphia because they couldn't control where they were landing various moments, trying to get out there, leave as soon as they can, if they have slaves with them. Because after 1788, you have 6 months after arriving with an enslaved person, and that before that person is declared to be free. So more of these refugees will try to point themselves elsewhere to Norfolk, to New York City, to Baltimore, and that's where they'll stay. But yes, a significant chunk of them do land in Philadelphia as well. The refugees tend to go, there's a steady drain after 1791, after the initial slave insurrections. But again, we have to remember that they don't have the benefit of our hindsight. They don't know that this is the beginning of a cataclysmic end to slavery on the island. And we also have to remember that those slave insurrections are localized. They're in certain regions of San Domingue and not in all of them. So it's not always clear for these people they're leaving forever, or that, that they're escaping an oncoming end of a plantation society. But they do leave in some numbers at that point, 1791, and then an immense number, about 10,000 leave, in 1793, after those events that I referenced before, with the liberating of slaves in the northern city of Cap-Français, that then evolves to become the emancipatory French policy in 1794. That's a big flotilla of refugees who bump their way up the coast, dropping people off, people are fleeing. Another large number end up going to Cuba later in the decade, and those people, after 1802, go to Louisiana, which is not yet an American territory, but as you know, will become. So there's another kind of influx. But there's also people who go back. There's ebbs and flow to this violence. We tend to think of it as one sort of continual cataclysmic series of events, but it is like anything else. War and chaos are not universal. Americans, in fact, are constantly trying to read the tea leaves to decide when different places are more or less safe to return to for these boom times to resume. That's how that works.
Okay. How did African Americans, free African Americans in Philadelphia, responding to this?
Fascinatedly. The evidence is harder to find. There's fewer literary sources, and there's more anecdotal sources, there's more sources, people of color in America being observed by those who write things down. And so there's another layer of interpretive kind of work to be done to figure things out. But I'm quite convinced that the African-American population in Philadelphia, which is increasingly a predominantly free population of color, though there's still slaves that endure there, but also enslaved people in Virginia and South Carolina are getting word of what's going on and are making something of it, to be sure. The Philadelphian population, which after all is has found itself and has come to a place where a certain kind of emancipation and free life is possible, has to be very careful about how they treat these events and how they relate them to their own realities. From best we can tell, leaders in the Black American community are faintly interested in holding up the violence in San Domingue and saying, look at the justice of a vengeful God. And so usually religious leaders as well. Look at the dangers of continuing to flout the biblical precept that God made of one blood all men. So let's ensure that this is something that should be hearkened to and made sense of in that sense. But it's dangerous to hold up too much of a warning, you know, to say this is something that you should look out for among that population because they are a minority and they are besieged. Even though they're in this relatively safe and safer place, they are not without their struggle.
And they don't want to be called a French Negro.
Right. Right. Yeah.
So talk about the connotations of that term.
Sure.
You could be labeled with that, and that was not going to help their cause trying to persuade white Americans to let African Americans have equality.
Right. Certainly, after a certain point, it becomes an entirely negative approbation or name altogether. But earlier on, there's more nuance to it, and there are some degrees of understanding and even acceptance to the notion that a French Negro is something not entirely negative. Initially, French Negro seems to connote a sense of insurgent slaves who are and therefore who may either be signs of the injustice of slavery or the necessity of slavery, depending on your understanding of that, but who are, you know, sort of into the winds, who could spread out and infect a plantation society elsewhere. Again, but that could be seen as a natural sort of freedom-loving thing done by mankind when oppressed, or as a scary, nefarious undercutting of planter authority. Once the French have adopted this policy of emancipation, those Americans, white and to some degree black as well, I would guess, who see the French Revolution as, again, this kind of revolutionary global force of republicanism acting against tyranny everywhere in all its forms. There are some people in American political discourse who look at French Negroes and say, yes, that is a force for good. They are valiant soldiers fighting against aristocratic and royalist bad guys. Few are those who will say, and therefore it's okay if they're here with us too, right? Though there are some, you know, iconoclastic voices that do say things like that, who say things like, look at the Plan du Nord, this famous place in Saint-Domingue where the violence really begins for the insurgent slaves. That is nothing more than what Lexington and Concord was in 1775. That is nothing more than mankind, another example of mankind striving to become free. And so that extent, a French Negro is an American Negro, right? Or is an American, right? Mm-hmm. So there are one of the things I think the book I like to think the book makes evident is that there's more fluidity, there's more sort of ideas up for grabs in this cacophonous and chaotic set of events than people tend to know. By the end of my story, French Negro is unambiguously a scary thing if you're a white person who's thinking about politics. There's no way to feasibly, I think, say Saint-Domingue's a good thing. You know, it's been reduced to a metonym for black violence. And that's my point. It's been a reduction. It's been a constriction of a wider array of possible meanings that were on display much earlier on.
Well, you just hit on something. It has to do with Americans are looking at the revolution or the insurgency or whatever you want to call it, the tumult of Saint Domingue, and they're using it, it's a way for them to try to understand their own American Revolution. And also, this is a new republic, okay? It's very new. It's a baby republic, and they're still trying to figure out, who are we? What happened? What did we just do? And you've got these republicanism and federalism, and they're, you know, vying for the future of the country. And this is happening when the nation is really forming its sort of self-awareness of who what America is or is to be. So I want you to talk a little bit about that, because I thought that was really interesting, because it was a very critical moment. It wasn't like America had been around for 100 years.
No.
We're still trying to figure it out.
Absolutely. Things were up for grabs. It's this dangerous combo in people's minds as you just said, the meaning, the fundamental essence of what this new revolutionary Republican polity was going to mean and be, and how it was going to act, and what it was going to look like, and how it was going to work, and the sense that there was only one answer to that. And so that if you saw people who opposed you or seemed to be acting in ways that you didn't judge to be part of what you saw as the meaning of the American Revolution and the polity that it had produced, they were not just, you know, people espousing a different opinion. They were vital enemies to the revolution. They were, you know, in some degrees, traitors. So this is not a moment when political parties accept each other as rivals for power. They see each other as dire enemies, as signs that, in fact, there are someone trying to undercut the meaning of the recent revolution and undo it to some degree. So, there's no provision in the American Constitution. There's no sense among the so-called founders that parties are something that is acceptable or that will naturally happen in this new polity. So when divisions do crop up in the 1790s, this is why the 1790s are so vital and so fascinating, I think, after 1793, certainly after 1795, and you have groups of people organizing to defeat each other in this political combat, it's immensely disruptive and scary and upsetting to people. And it accounts for the passion of their fights. So the fact that, A, they've got an example of a society seemingly falling apart that they're so familiar with in their viewpoint is one source of Saint-Domingue's weight. But two, that it involves a lot of the same issues that they believe themselves to be involved in. Struggles over the nature of a republic, struggles over the question of the extents of human equality, participation as citizenship, in a more general sense of a republic's struggle against a global aristocracy or a global monarchical power. The question that we started with, the question of the connections between republics everywhere. Should we now be, on the side of those French Republicans, even though they just emancipated slaves? It's a question. And some Americans answer yes. This is a moment when the French, as mentioned before, are contemplating a sort of a global fight, acting on it to some degree against forces of monarchy. They are themselves besieged by monarchical forces in Europe. And then have some successes against them. A famous French ambassador named Citizen Genet, your listeners probably have heard of him, lands in the United States and begins to arm Americans, and they are quite happy to go along with it against the British, maybe against the Spanish. There's a question of whether there's going to be a fight against the Spanish in Kentucky and Tennessee, an expedition. Certainly privateers that are being armed and sent out against British shipping in the Caribbean. Washington and that administration don't like this. This is when the Proclamation of Neutrality gets issued. But it's a real question about whether he's going to be able to sustain that.
I mean, there's also an argument going on or a debate going on all over about monarchs, whether they should be retained or eliminated. And people are, I mean, nobody's ever tried this before, you know, having nations without monarchs. And there's also the accusation from Republicans and the Federalists are really monarchs if they really want to establish a monarchy. And so the debate over the monarchy is all in there too.
Absolutely.
So that we're all going to be slaves.
Well, and or those who, the question is whether, living in a monarchical society is a constraint of liberty, or actually the best preservation of liberty. And that's the more conservative perspective, the Edmund Burke kind of version, is that, you know, everyone is equal in their inequality beneath the monarch because of the way that British monarchy has evolved through this, again, kind of republican framework that preserves individual liberties through their all common subjecthood, right? The emergent democratic republicans in the United States, the French republicans in Paris, you know, say that is, you know, a falsehood, that, you know, in fact, that is slavery, as you suggest, and you know, it needs to be fought against. But my point is that, you know, that Citizen Genet guy is running around the United States causing all the trouble he causes in American politics. His direct counterparts are operating in Saint-Domingue. You know, people in the same regime from the same sort of perspective are, you know, doing things like freeing slaves or offering slaves French citizenship and roles in the army. And Americans are seeing them in the same lens and seeing that as the same sort of project. And indeed it was. The ministers were talking to each other. The French ministers in Saint-Domingue were publishing things for American audiences to read so they understand what they wanted them to understand about what was going on. Genet was trying to feed these colonies, make sure that the British could be fought back. So, you know, Americans aren't wrong to see it all as pretty interrelated.
So I know your book is focused on Philadelphia, but I was just wondering, and you do talk a little bit about this, I'm wondering about, for you to talk a little bit about how the Southern plantation owners in America were seeing this.
Sure. I made a conscious decision not to focus there. I wanted to focus, because some of the literature that exists on this already has already focused in that direction, though mostly in the 19th century, where the story is my endpoint. The story is that reduced meaning of Saint-Domingue, that the function of that horrific, macabre, violent image among black and white audiences, mostly in the South. That's what they're looking at in the books I'm thinking about. And I saw more fluidity and more interest and more political vitality by looking at the place I did, Philadelphia, because it has to do with the print culture question you asked before. Because Philadelphia is such a center in the ways I described it, it also has this, you know, what is indisputably the most vibrant newspaper culture in the Young Republic. It is a place where once news arrives in Philadelphia, it blasts out across the eastern seaboard in a way that no other port and collection of newspapers can do. It has a national readership in the way other ports only have regional readerships. And given the way the news moved through clipping and reprinting, you know, after 1792, there's a Post Office Act that allows newspapers to move through the mail for free of charge. And within a very short amount of time, the vast bulk of American mail is newspapers moving free between editors for them to snip and clip and reprint stuff.
I think you say in your book that newspaper editors were often the postmen?
Yes, postmasters, yeah.
Postmasters?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that was...
Information moves through these things. You know, this is that paper vessel I was talking about before. By following that news, I'm able to avoid the kind of the more predominant reaction among planters, which was horror and resistance and deep, deep worry, which is there too. And it's there in Philadelphia too. Their ideas come into Philadelphia and are also spread out. But this other stuff is as well. And so I got a wider picture. There's also, we have to remember, south of Baltimore, the next big city of any size is Charleston, you know, and Savannah's there too, but it's pretty small. And those two cities do have newspapers, but they don't have the same kind of reach. These kinds of travel accounts that describe traveling between, you know, you talk about endless stretches of uninhabited land, as they think of it, or very sparsely inhabited land. Even though Charleston and Savannah are much closer geographically to Saint-Domingue, to this seat of action, the news they get is usually later, at least that which makes it into newspapers. You know, this way information moves in the Age of Sail actually bends geography in a certain sense, making Philadelphia closer to Saint-Domingue than places that were physically closer to it.
Right. One thing that I get from your book is I get the sense that we haven't paid enough attention to this. to this San Domingo and the Haitian Revolution and its the ideas that it came out of that shaped the future of the nation.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about the scholarship part of this. And I love the fact that your book is, you know, situated within an Atlantic context, and it kind of breaks this sort of idea that the United States was very exceptional, and it just connects it to so many bigger, broader things. I love that. So can you talk a little bit where you think the scholarship is on this, and how much more needs to be done, which I think a lot more needs to be done.
Yeah. Well, that's certainly, you just described the waters I hope to be swimming in very well. I mean, Haiti and the Haitian Revolution has experienced over the past 10 years or so a renaissance, a resurgence of interest among scholars. And it's mostly now being recovered as probably the most radical of the revolutions of the so-called era of Atlantic revolutions. By contrast, you know, the big studies, the land breaking and wonderful studies earlier on, I'm thinking of R.R. Palmer's The Age of the Democratic Revolution, a really influential two-volume study in the late 50s, early 60s, won the Bancroft Prize, wonderful, you know, came out of Princeton. Doesn't mention Haiti once. It's not even in the index.
Wow.
Just not there. And so there is a sea change now in the way we think about revolutions, their interconnectedness. I mean, Palmer was certainly doing a lot of interconnected thinking about what the relationship between revolutions, but the things that he was noticing about revolutions, the ways he was marking connection, couldn't include the kinds of things that make the Haitian Revolution useful to talk about, or it wasn't useful to him. So we're thinking about revolution differently now. We're thinking about it not just as a product of ideas, but also as a product of material culture and material structures. And we're measuring its intents, its directions, and its therefore its radical change, or the kinds of changes that get produced in different ways. The fact that this series of events leads to an independent polity, the second independent polity in the Western Hemisphere, in which citizenship is predicated on blackness, in which whiteness eliminates one from property ownership, it's undeniably, and so to people, you know, these days, sort of unavoidably, an incredibly radical moment, and one that, of course, people knew about and talked about and impacted the way they thought about their own doings and goings on.
Because, you know, Haiti is the first self-emancipation of enslaved people. Is that not correct? Right?
Yes, it is.
So when we're talking about the age of democratic revolutions, we're usually thinking about white middle-class people, bourgeois people, rising up against monarch.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And
yeah, we're thinking about, you know, in the classic thing, we're thinking about the development, the rise, and the spread of a notion, say, popular sovereignty, that the location of a nation's sovereignty can be other than its monarch, but in fact it stands above its monarch or its government altogether, and it comes from its people, and those people have some role in picking and running its government and all the things that come out of that. Saint-Domingue, you know, it's reasonable to not be included in that story, but it's not that reasonable. You have to include all the people. You have to think about the enslaved and their desires. You have to think about governance that doesn't necessarily look like a republic per se. The initial Haitian states aren't republics. In fact, there's a civil war, and one of the Haitian states becomes a monarchy. But there is a fundamental, although complicated, commitment to human freedom that underlies these things, these new polities. That, you know, I think, to my mind, makes it unavoidably part of the story. Beyond that, though, even if you don't want to talk about how this age fits together or doesn't fit together, the fact that my actors, the people I'm really interested in, Americans, knew about this thing and were thinking about these events, and those thoughts and that knowledge was constitutive and even formative to their own thoughts about what their revolution meant, I think makes it, you know, you can't leave it out. from even a more sort of nationally lined story. My story is a story about the United States, principally. It's a story about the United States and taking cognizance its wider connections and understandings of the world around it. That's a shift too. That's a shift towards understanding revolutions as not being done in one particular moment, but as being fluid and up for grabs politically, even if for the moment they're putatively over.
Yeah, it's almost like in the 1790s, the United States was still in a revolutionary period.
I certainly would see it so.
Right. It's still not settled exactly what America was to be. And Haiti sort of intervenes in that. So what do you think, in terms of as historians look at this period, what do you think the meaning of the Haitian Revolution is for us today, and where should we be considering it?
Well, I think, you know, American audiences, modern audiences, tend to, when they think about Haiti at all, tend to think of it as a marginal place in some sense, an impoverished place, a place where horrible things take place, where natural disasters strike, when natural disasters that cause a certain kind of damage in other places happen in Haiti, they cause an immense more damage and they lead to cholera and epidemics and mass suffering and places of political tumult and then like. We need to remember that, the period I'm looking at, things are entirely different. That this is the most modern, progressive, in some ways, central place on the planet, and at least in the Atlantic, that everyone, of course, knows about it. Everyone thinks about it and talks about it all the time, and is involved in it and interested in it in a certain visceral way, to the extent that we can't appreciate. And that makes us begin to think about, and here's where I'm leaving my area of expertise, but I have some ideas, about the reasons why Saint-Domingue and then Haiti, become this more marginal presence, and yet we can't forget this important history that this place has. This really, you know, sort of vital portion of human history, I think, that took place in the Haitian Revolutionary era.
Now, the United States did not recognize Haiti as a independent nation till like 1865 or something. 1860.
63.
Why is that?
Well, I mean, again, there's some of my colleagues who more better equipped to give you the specifics of it, but it has to do with my endpoint, which is one in which the meanings of Haiti are constrained, and its utility as a place to talk about divisive issues like slavery are eliminated. Right? It becomes a place that only has a single meaning. A place that means especially among white audiences, but not only, a place of black violence and horror and sort of a topsy-turvy society where things are wrong, right? It doesn't become useful in American political discourse again until the Civil War, right? When Southern representatives are no longer part of the National Council and some of the Republican groups, factions of the Republican Party, are interested in bringing it back into this way and recognizing it as an institution, as a sovereign nation. I to put it in my story, you know, it's a resumption of its relevance as part of contemporary debates that that you see in the 1860s that had ceased after 1808 or so.
So basically, the people in America who saw the Haitian situation as wholly a negative thing won.
For a time,
It turns or the interpretation.
Yeah. No, I mean, even so, if you do a, you can do sort of hunts through databases and online stuff now to look for Saint Domingo in 19th century language and discourse, and you'll find it. People still talk about Saint Domingo, but it almost is always appended as the horrors of Saint Domingo. It is almost always, at least on, sort of pro-Southern pro-slavery audiences, it's seen as this scary, it's described in this way of criticizing interference with slavery. Even among African-American audiences, they're unable to avoid or evade that meaning. It becomes purely a way to articulate rage and resistance.
So it makes the abolitionist cause a little more difficult to persuade people that we can free the slaves and it's going to be okay.
Yes.
Because people can point to Haiti and go, oh, you wanted to be like Haiti. And you could also say, well, we're trying to avoid Haiti being proactive, right?
Yeah. You know, latter-day abolitionists talk about Haiti, talk about the nobility of Toussaint Louverture and talk about, you know, it sort of becomes a stock picture. And yeah, it's actually a holdover of an earlier vein, the one I mentioned before of talking about the injustice of slavery as what produces slave violence, and therefore there's something acceptable about that kind of slave violence. That thread does endure into the Garrisonian abolitionist page field as well. But as you say, it's much easier to point at that and say, but look at the violence and look at the place that it's become and all sorts of, you know,
this is what happens with black people rule.
Right. And they could, you know, that's the sort of line they could make it into this, simply this savage, atavistic kind of, land. When in fact, even at that moment, it's a very interesting place, a vibrant place, a besieged place, a place that has to, constantly worry about being reinvaded and a place that whose contacts with the world are increasingly circumscribed. And a place that's being, that various natural resources are being extracted from it and these sorts of things that make it besieged in another sense. But it's a human place. It's got lots of interesting and wonderful things going on in it.
Okay, so I'm going to have just a little final question for you here. What would you like your reader to take away from your book? What have you not been able to say in our time together that you would like to say?
Well, you've given me a chance to say a lot, so I do appreciate it. I mean, in addition to that, just cognizance of Haiti as a place that's central and interesting and is not simply something that falls along our modern assumptions, I would point to the things we've hinted at, but I think are important from the book. The point that American political culture, probably anyone's political culture, are fluid things. They're not set in stone. The meanings of a revolution, the results of a movement, they're not fait accomplis. They're things that are hashed out in politics, and not just by leaders, but also by middling sorts and lower sorts. They are fluid, and therefore revolutions are a process. And therefore, when you tell a story like I've tried to do here, where there's more than one revolution at hand, you see the ways in which not all revolutions are created equal, right? The meaning of the Haitian Revolution, as I just mentioned before, is one that had to be argued for, when in fact contemporaries to it in America understood it as densely interrelated with their own. It got lost. That's a big loss, in fact, that it gets lost to history until pretty recently, when it's been discovered to be, this really intricate and interesting and impactful and important series of events. So there's, power works in societies at the time to sort of mediate how things go. It also works in history to determine what's there for us to talk about and how we can conceptualize even the movements that we're trying to analyze. Above all, that points to the need to not just think about the nation state, but to think about the way things are connected across the world.
Okay, thank you, Alex.
Thank you very much.
Thank
Appreciate
you for your to our listeners tuning in to another edition of New Books in American Studies. It would be a pleasure to hear from you. You can reach me through my website at www.lillianbarger.com. This is your host, Lillian Barger.